Welcome this afternoon to the Second Court of Appeals. We've had a couple of cases cancel. I think there's a bout of illnesses going around. And unfortunately, I have succumbed to that too. I have quite the cough, so please excuse me if I get going during the oral argument today. While you all are our sole oral argument, we have two other cases that are submitted on briefs today that we will conference on after your presentation. We are very lucky today to have visiting with us, to my left, Justice Charles Blyle visiting, and then to my right is Justice Bill Meyer. And we are your panel today, and with that, the clerk will call our case.
The court will now call Henry Mahoney and Mahoney Management, LLC versus Dan Monet. Members of the court, Mr. David R. Sweat will argue for the appellant, Mr. Michael A.
May it please the court, in this particular case, this is a contract case in which Dan Monet relies on a contract designated as Exhibit 5 in support of his $200,000 claim, and at the same time claims that the copy of the contract that Mr. Romani produced without the $200,000 is not the true contract. Obviously, in this case, the contract, what the true contract was and what the true contract said, was of primary importance in the case. So with regard to Exhibit 5, Mr. Bonet's alleged contract, I'd like to address that in three respects, because Mr. Bonet has three problems with that contract. And I have some other points as well, but those are in the brief, and I may not reach all of them, but obviously I'm not waiving anything in the brief. With regard to his problems, the first problem he has is he can't produce the original contract. The second one is that the contract he did produce is usurious on its face. And the third problem that he has is, because of the divorce that he went through, he probably doesn't own at least half of that contract, if that's the true contract. And based on what the family court would do, he might not even own that much. So first, with regard to the original, Rule 1002, Texas Rules of Evidence, provides that the original is what has to be produced. And there is an exception in Rule 1004 of the Rules of Evidence that says, well, if you can prove that the original was destroyed or it was lost or it's now in the possession of the opposing party, well, then you can use a copy in lieu of an original. Mr. Bonet, in this case, didn't prove any of that. And the difference is, it's one thing to say, it's something else to actually put on evidence of that. And in the record, there simply is no evidence as to what happened to it. In fact, if you look at how it was admitted, he simply offered a copy, I objected, and the trial court admitted it without any inquiry as to what where it was or what happened to it or where it was today. We think that that's simply improper was an error to admit Exhibit 5 into evidence. Specifically, given the fact that Mr. Bonet's case basically turned on Exhibit 5, it was an error to allow that in without any proper predicate as required by Rule 1004. Even if that contract was properly admitted, and if it was in fact a contract, it's usurious on its face. Mr. Romani pled, both defendants pled as a defense, that the contract is usury. It provides for 10% per month interest after maturity. Interest is compensation for the detention of money. If you do the very simple math that's required there, 10% a month is 120% a year, and the court instructed the jury that 18% per annum is the maximum lawful interest rate in Texas. there's not any ambiguity there. 10% a month is 10% a month. And Mr. Binet at trial attempted to, once he figured out that that was really an issue, it's very interesting that in his pleadings, he pled for the 10% interest. And then when he got to trial and discovered that that was a problem, then he tried to skate around that by saying, well, I never intended to do that. I don't want to charge that. I don't want the money. Now, that may have convinced the jury to make the finding they did, but the contract says what the contract says.
But the jury finding wasn't specifically on usury, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. The jury finding.
What issue number was that?
That was
17.
I believe it was 17 is correct, and it was. I think it was. You know, did the interest rate exceed the maximum interest rate? And they were instructed that the maximum interest rate was 18.
Okay, so doesn't that just go to? My question is that the fact that a contract may be usurious doesn't act to void the contract as to the principal. It may act to void the contract as to the potentially usurious interest, but I'm not following that the whole entire contract was void because of interest usury.
Well, it's not. However, the statutory penalty is three times the amount of the interest that exceeds the maximum rate. So if you do the computation there, 18% and then 120%, if you do the math on that, it ends up to like over $3 million in interest, which is far in excess. So if you apply the penalty, it simply wipes out the recovery.
Okay.
And as we pointed out in the brief, the court can take judicial notice of the penalty and do the math. It's fairly simple math. To the extent that that counsel has argued that, well, there may be some other brief out there, there's simply nothing in the record that there's another brief other than Exhibit 5. That's Mr. Binet lives and dies by that, and in several places in the record, you know, Mr. Binet says this was it. I drafted this. We signed it. We did it. This is it. And the contract itself says that in order for there to be any modifications, it would have to be signed by all the parties to the agreement. Which there's nothing in the record that shows that at all.
Okay, my next question concerning Exhibit 5 is that even if the trial court did err by admitting it, isn't it harmless if the original would have shown the exact same thing?
Well, in this particular case, the original would show that that wasn't the original. The original, you know, our position was the original is Exhibit 6, and that had initials on it, and the... we don't think there, you know, it may be that the original doesn't exist anymore because Mr. Binet decided the original was not convenient. One has to remember that in February of 2009, after he had left for Belize, he fabricated a new note that said that the limited partnership was actually the one that owed him $200,000. And he signed that note on behalf of a limited partnership that he no longer owned an interest in. And the court found that that was not an enforceable contract.
Okay, but concerning Exhibit 6 and Exhibit 5, both of those were before the jury.
Both of those were before the jury.
And the jury basically decided?
One has to assume that the jury, you know, liked this one and didn't like that one, and or perhaps they just felt sorry for Mr. Binet because he gave them a story about how poor he was and how he was living on the beach in a little house and
but
so forth.
I guess my point is that between Exhibit 5 and Exhibit 6, Exhibit 5, it's not your contention that the original would have shown something different than what is on Exhibit 5, that there is a different Exhibit 5 that has alterations to the actual Exhibit 5. Your position is that the true contract was Exhibit 6.
We believe the original would be Exhibit 6, and that what Mr. Benet did was he took the signature page from Exhibit 6 and then fabricated a new number of pages without initials and called it Exhibit 5.
You believe that, but what's the factual basis that was before the jury to support your belief?
We pointed out a number of discrepancies. One of the discrepancies was that Exhibit 5, for example, has the page numbers at the bottom, and the last page is page 5 of 4, which is somewhat unusual, unless perhaps you've made some changes in the word processor and you kicked over another page. There were things that were taken out that would have been favorable to somebody other than Mr. Benet. And
you mean that we're in 5 and not in 6?
Right. And there's the spacing is different. I mean, it's clearly not a document that was produced on a word processor line after line. There's a lot of things in there that are different. And, obviously our position, and my client believes that, he's got the right copy, and that, he didn't see Exhibit 5 and didn't know where it came from.
The jury didn't accept that position.
That's true.
But let's get back to what you first said about the usurious point. If it is usurious and it's improper under our law, wouldn't the remedy be to modify the judgment to allow the maximum interest payable under the law?
That's not what the penalty is. The statutory penalty is because that would basically write the usury law off the books if you could just go back and fix it. The only real defense to a usury claim would be that it was a bona fide error and that you fixed it before there was a suit filed. I mean, there is a statutory defense there,
okay.
But that wasn't used in this case. And in fact, like I said, Mr. Benet went to trial with the 10%, asking the court to award the 10% in the contract. So it's kind of hard to say that he didn't intend to charge usurious interest when he's asking the court for it. Like I said, during trial, I think he changed his mind when he realized where he was at.
So there was a separate pleading by your client, or a separate paragraph in the pleading, asserting a counterclaim for a usury penalty.
We asserted it as not as a counterclaim, but as a defense in the nature of an offset and recoupment. I guess the effect would be the same. The effect would be the same, except that we would not get affirmative relief on the claim. We would only get relief to the extent it's a defense against the contract. The third problem that Mr. Benet has with his contract is that he says it was done in September of 08. My client testified that the contract Exhibit 6 was actually done much earlier than that, at the beginning of the year, which is where it was effective. But Mr. Benet during this time was going through a divorce. And in his testimony and at the plea and abatement hearing as well, there really wasn't any question about that. This contract was done while they were married. All these business transactions were done while they were married. And the court has before it the divorce decree, which doesn't mention anything about this contract or Shuracat, any of the claims that Mr. Benet was making that he was entitled to money. They're not in that divorce decree. In fact, he basically admitted that he never told his wife about it. And
doesn't that just give rise to a claim by his wife for any monies he recovers?
It gives rise to a claim by his wife for the money that she's entitled to under the contract. And that's the problem, is that she has a claim and he has a claim. He can't sue on her behalf. I think he does not have standing to sue for money that's owed to her, and she wouldn't have standing to sue for money.
And was a standing issue raised in the trial court?
I think standing can be raised for the first time on appeal. We did raise it. We raised it in our motion for new trial. We raised it in the plea and abatement. She needs to be in the lawsuit because, as the court pointed out, in Supreme Court pointed out in Taylor versus Catalan, what should happen in this case is what we tried to do, which is grant the plea and abatement, bring the ex-wife in, then you've got all the parties and all the claims all in one basket, and then the court can deal with them. And the difference in the Taylor case was apparently the parties didn't file a plea and abatement. So the Supreme Court, you know, didn't have the option of sending it back because that had been waived. But instead, they went forward and said, you can only sue on the part of the claim that you own. And if you own half, you only get half. And so they rendered a judgment for half instead of the whole. And that makes sense because otherwise, what would keep, if he can sue on behalf of the ex-wife, then why can't the ex-wife sue Mr. Romani for the full amount of the contract? And now we're looking at $400,000 instead of $200,000. So that's the, our feeling is the court just misinterpreted what needed to happen there.
It's very touching, your concern for Ms. Benet, but I still don't see your concern about that. Isn't that a matter between her and Mr. Benet, if at all?
No, Your Honor. It's because as we've tried to raise in the trial court, you have this problem that Rule 39 tries to deal with, where you don't want to have multiple lawsuits over the same issues, and that's why we try to get everybody in the court at the same time. And in fact, Rule 39 puts the burden on the plaintiff in Section C, I believe it is, puts the burden on the plaintiff to prove or plead, here's why she's not in the case and here's why we can't join her. And they didn't make any attempt to do that. They never gave a reason for not joining her, probably because he didn't want her to know about it. My time's up. Thank you.
Time has expired. Thank you. Will you please add another minute?
May it please the court. I think what appellant's counsel is trying to do is really tie in multiple issues together that are really separate and distinct issues before the court. The first issue that was before the court that raised by point of error was the lack of use of an original of the contract that was Exhibit 5. And we've cited the testimony from the trial court where Mr. Benet testified that contract was in Mr. Romani's possession when the two separated, that contract, the original contract, was in Mr. Romani's office. And what the rule says is that if the contract is in the other party's possession, it's not up to you to have to produce an original when you don't have it. But the Exhibit 5 aside, that was not the only evidence that the jury had to work from to try and find that there was a breach of contract in this case and that Mr. Romani and Romani Management owed Mr. Benet over $200,000. That was also established, and we've cited all the exhibits in the briefing, through other written agreements between the parties, through emails involving the parties, and through oral testimony about what was agreed to between the parties. So when we look at the jury's results today, we really don't know exactly what it is they relied upon in finding that Henry Romani and Romani Management breached their agreement with Mr. Benet, because there was a multitude of evidentiary reasons they could have based their decision upon. All we know is that they did find that there was a breach of that agreement. The issue then of the usury, I think, is really kind of a red herring. And the first part of the problem is what I just said, which is we really don't know exactly what the jury based their decision upon regarding breach of contract, whether it was just Exhibit 5 or whether it was all the other documentation and testimony supporting an agreement and a breach of that agreement by Mr. Romani. And if we don't know what they based their decision on. We also don't know whether or not that clause even needs to be interpreted. But even if it does need to be interpreted, I've cited the sections of the finance code that talk about that the usury provision cited by appellant's counsel go to creditors, and that Mr. Benet doesn't really meet those definitions, and I don't think that those provisions would even apply in an individual on an individual context like this. The third issue that was raised was the issue of whether or not Mr. Benet had standing based upon the community property issue, and whether or not he only owned half of it, whether or not Ms. Benet should have been a party under Rule 39, and how that proceeded was like this. Appellants filed a plea and abatement and asked the case be abated, but they never actually themselves attempted to make Ms. Benet a party to the case, and clearly they could have. If you look at the plea and abatement transcript, you'll even note that the relief that was requested by Mr. Sweat was, what we've requested the court to do is simply abate it and grant the plaintiff an opportunity to amend to do whatever is necessary to remedy the defects of the parties. So again, they weren't asking the court to bring Ms. Benet into the case. All they were asking the court to do at that hearing and with that motion was merely to abate the case. And the court denied it, and I think rightfully so. They've spent some time arguing basically this was a Rule 39 problem. And the Rule 39 problem is multitude of suits, multitude of liabilities. But we are now more than 6 years from any particular date of contract that you could use in this. And so there's no issue of multitude of suits, no issue of multitude of liability at this time. And the other issues that get raised in Rule 39 about whether or not a party needs to be brought in is whether or not a claim was ever asserted related to the subject action by the potential third party, which would be Ms. Benet in this case. And it's undisputed that she has never made any type of claim in this case. As was also the circumstance that was pointed out in the briefing and kind of referenced by the bench, is Ms. Benet was not a party to any of the contracts. Ms. Benet was not an owner of any of the shares of any of the companies that were in dispute, and there's no evidence to the contrary about that. It's undisputed. And so what we are really hearing from appellants in this case about this community property issue is not fact. What we're hearing is suspicion. It's never been established that any of this, any of these agreements, any of these liabilities were in fact community property. Mr. Benet testified that he used property that he owned well prior to marriage to fund a lot of the entities and the organizations and so forth. So if there's an issue of community property or not, the first thing that would have to happen would be a family law court would have to determine is there indeed any community property involved, and then determine what's the proper disposition of that property. But that was never an issue that the trial court in this case had any responsibility to decide. And more importantly, what we're hearing is an argument of standing that the court asked about. And if there was an issue or contention about standing, the way to address that would have been a Rule 93 verified affirmative defense that Mr. Benet did not have standing regarding some or all of his causes of action prior to trial. And that didn't occur. And when that doesn't occur, what the law says is that's waived. And so I think that's been waived.
Well, clearly he has standing to assert the breach of contract. The question is more of whether the issue that's being raised is more whether he has standing to obtain the entire remedy. And to me, that's a matter between Mr. Benet and Ms. Benet based on the divorce decree.
And I agree. And what my point of that is, if the appellants wanted to contend at trial that Mr. Benet did not have standing for some of the recovery sought at, what the law says is he was required to file an affirmative defense in that regard prior to trial, and they didn't do that. And so I don't think that issue was one that the court had an opportunity to consider. I don't think it was something that Mr. Benet was required to put on proof about because the issue wasn't raised, and therefore the issue was waived.
Mr. Francis.
Yes, sir.
I'd like to talk to you about Exhibits 5 and 6.
Yes, sir.
How did your client and your witness, or your witnesses, explain the fact that Exhibit 6 appears to be have been initialed on each page and signed, and that the signature page, which is page 4 of 4, is identical to the signature page that is page 4 of 4 on Exhibit 5?
Yes, sir. My client testified that the initials that were purported to be his initials on those pages were not his initials, that he did not write those. We actually spent a great deal of time pointing out to the jury the discrepancies between the two agreements, and I think the overriding evidence was the discrepancies in pagination, in paragraph blocks, and all those other things actually much more supported the notion that Mr. Benet's version of the contract, Exhibit 5, was more likely the legitimate contract, and that Exhibit number 6 had more discrepancies, which would indicate that it was a fraudulent document. And so we did. That was something that both parties spent a number of spent significant time trying to argue in front of the jury through all those various differences between them. And again, I think the evidence really much more established that Mr. Benet's contract version, the Exhibit 5, was a much more credible document.
Why does Exhibit 5 have page 5 of 4 on the end of it without anything typed on it?
Because it was drafted by a non-lawyer who had probably some residual stuff, you know, some spacing carryover, rather than somebody who went back later and tried to clean it up and change it to make it a version more.
Who drafted Exhibit 5?
Mr. Benet.
Yes, sir. Exhibit 5 is the one that contains a paragraph dealing with a purchase price.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's on page 2 of 4, and it specifically says on page 2 of 4 that if principals default, the transferee will have the right to impose a default charge equal to $20,000 with interest of 10% monthly on the balance, continuing until payment is made in full.
It does.
If there is a promise to make a payment in the future, then isn't that an extension of credit?
The agreement was intended to be basically a fairly immediate transaction of an exchange for shares and exchange for payment. And that was only a penalty provision in the event that payment, for whatever reason, didn't come as contemporaneously as contemplated at the time the parties entered into the agreement, which unfortunately turned out to be the case.
Well, the document that you're claiming is on Exhibit 5 says at the top of it that it's to be as of the first day of January 2008. And then this paragraph I was just reading you about when payments to be made is September 1st of 2008. There's a period of 9 months there in which there's not a payment contemplated in your version of the contract.
Yes, Your Honor. And the testimony was that the contract was not actually signed until on or about September 1st, 2008 date. And what you have, unfortunately, is you have a bunch of non-lawyers who are business partners trying to draft agreements between themselves and doing a very ham-handed job.
That's what gets us here sometimes.
That's correct.
And the point being of the usury law, in terms of the finance code itself, it has a specific section that says that it is usurious to charge, receive, or demand payment for an amount in excess of the 18%, that's the maximum usury rate. In other words, a creditor who contracts for, charges, or receives interest that is greater than the amount authorized by this subtitle is liable to the obligor for an amount that's equal to the greater of 3 times the amount computed by the contract, and number 2, 20%. So If this contract is number five, exhibit number five, is the basis for our claim, I know you cite other things and say other things could have been the reason, but the $200,000 came from a transfer of shares, didn't it?
All the agreements were related to $200,000 for a transfer of shares, but yes, that contract specifically contemplated that transaction.
And that's because the limited partnership that was formed between Rahamani and Mr. Benet was 50% owned by Mr. Benet, 49% owned by Mr. Rahamani, and then 1% owned by his LLC, Rahamani Management. Is that right?
That's correct.
So the 50% that was contemplating being sold was the 50% that was owned by Mr. Benet.
Correct.
And if that's a sales transaction and it's a matter of payment in terms of credit on the document itself, what you're telling me is there was testimony that varied the terms of the written instrument that said it's going to be paid, it's signed on January 1st, and it's dated January 1st, and it's to be effective January 1st, and payments to be made on September 1st. That's all the terms of a written instrument.
That's what the document states, yes.
Then it's explained away by the fact that, well, it was really not that way. It was really all done in September of 2008 and not January of 2008. And that's the reason why it was really just a cash transaction and there's no creditor involved and therefore no usury.
I think it's actually a few other points in that. That is part of certainly an argument. But the other part of the argument is Mr. Benet, when you look at 305.001 of the finance code, it talks about this provision applies to creditors. And a creditor means a person who loans money or otherwise extends credit. But I don't think, and this term does not include a judgment creditor, I don't believe, or at least we argue, that Mr. Benet does not constitute a creditor to trigger this provision. But the other part of it is, because there is a multitude of other evidence supporting an agreement for Mr. Rahamani to pay Dan Benet $200,000 for his half ownership in the company WWWDH, we don't know if the jury relied upon this contract or looked at the other evidence. And if we don't know if the jury relied on this contract, we don't know if we can even apply the terms of this contract to the finance code provisions or not. And what we do know is the jury was given a very explicit question, you know, was there usurious interest sought by plaintiff? And they found that the answer was no. And that would support the notion that they looked to other places possibly to establish a basis for a breach of contract claim and not necessarily relied either totally or at all on exhibit number five. That's the difficulty of a case like this is, frankly, we don't know. But if we don't know if that's the only basis, I don't think you can unilaterally apply this kind of credit on the judgment if we don't know if the judgment was based upon exhibit five.
Well, how can it not be based on exhibit five? How can question number 17 not be based on exhibit five?
Well, it's a matter of,
because it's only usury if it's in a contract. If it's in an email or any of the other evidence that your testimony, other things like that, that can't support a finding of usury. So in question 17, the jury's answer had to be based on exhibit five.
Well, there was an exhibit two that was also an agreement between the parties that talked about numbers. There were some emails that talked about an agreement for $200,000 between the parties showing their agreement. There's no question Mr. Benet transferred the 50% ownership to Mr. Rahamani, who then shortly thereafter sold the company for $400,000.
Okay, I'm with you on that.
Right.
I'm with you on the other evidence concerning that exhibit five was the contract that the parties intended. But as to, okay, so you get that. As to question 17, that question has got to be based on the terms of Exhibit 5. The jury's answer to that has got to be based. And also then I'm thinking, well, isn't that a question of law based on Exhibit 5?
And I would argue on that that if the jury answered no, that may be the jury telling us that we relied upon other evidence that had no interest provision at all, and that's why we answered that question no. We can't know what was in the mind of the jury, but if the jury based their opinion that the agreement was reflected by something other than Exhibit 5 that they found for breach of contract, those other evidentiary basis, the Exhibit 2, the emails, all those other things, had no interest provisions.
But the question says, for question number 17 says, for a contract made for business, commercial, investment, or similar purpose, the maximum lawful interest rate which a creditor may charge is 18% per year.
Yes.
So it has to be based on a contract. I'm not seeing how a jury's no answer to the usury finding can be based on anything other than Exhibit 5.
Well, Exhibit 2, if I recall, was an agreement between the parties is what it was titled. There was also discussion about testimony about we had an agreement. Here's what the terms of the agreement were from Mr. Benet. And so as far as what they found to be the contract, meaning the offer and acceptance, you know, and what the agreed terms were, I don't know if they derived what they believed to be the contract forming the basis of their judgment from Exhibit 5 or found some of the other evidence to them established a contract that they used to award Mr. Benet the money that they awarded him.
Okay. My next question is, were there any objections to the jury charge question number 17 by you?
I'll be honest, I don't recall.
I know, it's been a while.
And I don't want to mislead. I don't recall.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
One more thing, Judge. I know it's a lot. I know we're getting over.
Go ahead.
Counsel, there is another document you keep talking about, other documents that talks about $200,000. And Defendant's Exhibit 6 has got at the top of it, promissory note. And it says it's between Daniel D. Benet of Fort Wayne, Indiana, and WWDHLP of 9500 White Ray White Suite, Fort Worth. And then it's signed lender information, Daniel D. Benet, and it's his signature. And then it says borrower information, WWDHLP, and is also signed by Daniel D. Benet. Now, Mr. Benet was not the general partner of the limited partnership that was known as WWDHLP, was he?
He was not.
Can a limited partner sign off on a note for the partnership?
He cannot.
And what was there testimony? I haven't looked at this part of the record yet. I'm reading through it, but I haven't gotten that far yet. I'd like for you to tell me your recollection of the testimony that Mr. Benet provided as to why he signed both as the lender and the borrower on a promissory note. That's the Defendant's Exhibit 6.
And we didn't raise that as a basis for a contract claim. It was brought up by appellants. And what his explanation was, basically, he had transferred his shares in exchange for $200,000 that he thought he was going to get contemporaneously. He got a series of extensions and excuses, and I'm going to have someone else pay it. I'm going to do all these other things to get you your money. And during that time, Mr. Romani was going through the process of trying to sell the company. Mr. Benet's explanation, as I recall it, was basically that he was trying to do something to muddy the title, to make sure that Mr. Romani didn't sell the company, run off with the money, and he had no protection to get paid.
And how would this document, Exhibit 6, how would that protect him to get paid?
I think it's just more of a matter of when they tried to do the company, the primary asset of WWDH was a mixed-use commercial building, retail on the bottom, and business and office space up top. And by filing something that when a title company you know, does some kind of lien search or what have you, shows some kind of creditor issue, it can have the ability to stall the closing process. And Mr. Benet, I guess I'd characterize it as made a misguided effort without legal counsel to try and basically protect himself from getting taken.
He signed this document in front of a notary public and filed it in the deed records, Terry.
You know, who he signed it in front of, who notarized it, I mean, I can't
answer
that.
I'm looking at it, and it says Brandon Stepp, Notary Public of Texas.
And I have no reason to doubt the signature. I'm not saying the signature is not Mr. Benet's. I have no reason to doubt it, and I have no reason to doubt the notary. I just don't have personal knowledge of exactly that mechanics. But it certainly, that's what it appears to be on the face of the document.
All right, thank you for answering my question, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Francis. Will you add 1 minute for rebuttal?
How much?
Oh, we're giving you an extra minute. We've been asking a lot of questions today.
Thank you, Honor, and I appreciate an opportunity to answer those. Where should I start? First of all, I think with regard, going back to Exhibit 5, since we're very interested in Exhibit 5, in Mr. Benet's own testimony, as I remember in the record, is the payment was due September 1st, but he says this agreement wasn't signed until middle to end of September. So, as I recall, I asked Mr. Benet, so you're telling me that when Mr. Romani signed this agreement, he was already in default? And Mr. Benet said, yeah, I guess that's right, which doesn't make sense, and certainly doesn't make sense to Mr. Romani. I think in answer to the questions, I think counsel finally conceded that Mr. Benet is clearly a creditor in this case. And with regard to these other contracts, Exhibit 2 is a memo from Henry Romani to somebody named Marco Caruso in Belize, authorizing a $200,000 transfer to Mr. Benet, which Mr. Romani says was the result of some transactions, some business deals that they had going on in Belize and had nothing to do with WWWDH. Now, how do you make that a contract when it doesn't even mention the limited partnership that supposedly is an issue? I don't know how you do that. I think the answer is you don't. What I do know is that in the trial of the case, Mr. Benet's counsel asked him, and if we look at, just so the jury can see what Exhibit 5 is, Exhibit 5 is a transfer of shares of the partnership of WWWDHLP, correct? That's correct. And this is a document whereby you were agreeing to transfer your shares in that company and thereby your half of the building in exchange for the compensation reflected in the agreement. That's correct. So what's this contract we're relying on? If it's not Exhibit 5, there's no evidence in the record of any contract. I guess the only other evidence in the record is Exhibit 6, which is the true exhibit. With regard to the abatement, I simply think the court was in error there. The rule says that if there's a party that needs to be joined, that party shall be joined. It doesn't put the burden on the defendant to do that. It says the court is supposed to do it. The plaintiff is supposed to explain who that party is and why they can't be joined. But if there's no explanation of why they can't be joined, then it's the trial court's responsibility to require joinder. Furthermore, going along with Mr. Benet's testimony in that respect, one of the questions that we ask him concerning these claims, the claim, the $200,000 and the Sharecat claim, I ask him directly, and all of those claims then would be part of the community property that was divided in this divorce, right? In this divorce. And his answer was, right. I think he conceded this was community property. He knew it was community property. The Harrell case, the Supreme Court case, says as a matter of law it's community property. There's the family code has a presumption that any property acquired during marriage is community unless it is specifically the separate property definitions.
The fact that a recovery could be community property wouldn't change a litigant's standing to pursue or to assert a breach of contract claim.
I think it would. You can't sue him. You know, he had the burden of proof. Mr. Bonet had the burden of proof to show, just like if you're suing on a note, you have to show you're the holder of the note. Well, he has to show he's the holder of this contract claim. And what he proved as a matter of law is he owns no more than half of it. And I suppose if they wanted to go back to family court.
But there's no independent breach concerning Ms. Bonet. There's a breach of contract directed towards Mr. Bonet, and he has standing to pursue recovery based on that alleged breach. Then to the extent that any recovery that he gets could be classified as community property, why wouldn't that just give rise to Ms. Bonet's right to sue him to get half of whatever he got?
Because when the divorce occurred, because it's an undivided asset, she became an owner as a matter of law. It was an assignment as a matter of law to her. So she now owns, she's a joint tenant, a joint owner of that
half
contract.
Half of any recovery for breach of contract.
Yes. And that's why I think her joinder was so critical, and why the failure to require that is an error that should be repaired by this court.
Does that mean that anytime you sue an individual for money recovery, that and that individual is married, you have to join the spouse?
No, because that would be, I think that's a different situation. If you have, and you get into join and separate, you may, but if it's joint management community property, either spouse has the right to manage that property so they can do it. What makes this different is the divorce fractures the community. There is no community anymore. Now there's two people, and it's just like it would be basically the same thing as if you and I owned a house together. Okay, we're joint tenants. We each have an interest in it. In this case, they jointly own an interest in that contract, and I would say that Taylor versus Catalan says that they own it equally, and each of them needs to be involved, and each of them can sue for their half without joinder or the other.
But the distinction in your hypothetical is there's no asset until there's a recovery.
Well, the asset is the cause of action. In the Taylor versus Catalan case, it was a personal injury claim, and the court said it. This was a community property claim. It was it was not divided in the divorce. Therefore, it's owned 50-50. I think it's the same.
Last question, Judge. I want you to recall for us, if you can, Mr. Sweat, at the charge conference, did you object to the submission of a fact question to the jury on what is the meaning of usury in Texas? On question 17 in the court's charge.
Yes.
It asked the jury to determine whether the usury laws had been violated. I'm just curious as to whether you might, if you thought that was a question of law rather than a question of fact, and if you made an objection to the trial court in submitting that issue.
I think I argued to the court that we had proved it as a matter of law. But the court wanted to submit it, so we gave him an issue to submit.
I hadn't looked to see if the charge conference was recorded. Do you know if it was?
I believe it is.
All right.
I believe it is.
Mr. Sweat, you have time to make a prayer, and I think your time's expired.
Thank you, Your Honor. My last comment, I guess, would be, with regard to Defendant's Exhibit 6, the contract that was fabricated by Mr. Bonet later, yes, he did do it to tie up the property. And one would have to ask seriously, why would you do that if you already had a contract that said the limited partner and the managing partner and the general partner, if all the partners owe you money and you have a contract that says that, why would you go to the trouble of fabricating another contract with a different party for the same money? And I think the answer is what it is. I haven't addressed some of the other points. I'd ask the court to seriously consider those points, particularly with regard to the liability of the LLC. And we believe that overall, there are so many points that cause problems with this judgment that the court should, on the usury issue, reverse and render the case. But if the court doesn't do that, I think there's no avoiding a remand for a new trial. Thank you.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for appearing here today and for your arguments and your briefing. Clearly, your arguments have been very helpful to the court. You've answered a lot of questions for us, and we appreciate that. And have safe travels back. And with that, we will be adjourned.